Hello and welcome to WB40, podcast around the world of technology with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. So as the gratuitous sound of sleigh bells disappear unsubtly into the background, welcome to the last episode of WB40 before the end of 2016. How's it going, Chris?
Well, Matt, that was fantastic, wasn't it? I think your sleigh bell expertise has been hid under a bushel. Is it something you only bring out at Christmas? I suppose it's a seasonal thing, isn't it? How long did that take you?
All of about 20 seconds. The hardest bit was finding the sample.
Really? Oh, no. You mustn't let the magic out. The people will be listening to that and thinking you spent all week on it.
Yeah, all week. Absolutely. This week we are going to look back at what has been something of a tumultuous year. Pick up on 10 things that what we have learned from it. To be able to do that in a way that hopefully maintains a reasonable sense of levity without getting into... I mean, did you hear Ian McCaskill's gone now as well? As if this year get any worse, Ian McCaskill.
And Walter Swinburne as well. If you're a horse racing fan, Walter Swinburne has also passed away today. So now, as if 2016 is saving itself up for a final flurry.
Well, you always get famous people dying at Christmas as well. So this one's just going to be like some sort of bloodletting. It doesn't bear thinking about. Anyway, on to lighter subjects.
I think it's definitely been an eventful year for me and for everybody else. So the things that I have found out about this year, maybe learned some lessons or reinforced a few things for me. I blogged about them today, and they're on my post on LinkedIn at the moment. But the first one is that it's really hit home to me this year how much a difference it makes if you're helping somebody with a problem to your own learning. I'm always saying every day is a school day. You're always learning as you go ahead, and you're always learning as you work with people. But also, I've been doing some mentoring this year, and just that process of saying pretty obvious things, a little bit of experience and encouragement, it just makes you think about your experience in a different way. It makes you think about your experience helps you understand why you did things and how you might do things differently next time. And that's been a massively useful learning experience for me. So I think that's one of the things that I've got out this year. Is it really one of the best ways to learn is to help somebody else with a problem?
It's something I think I learned myself when I spent a couple of years doing management training. And to be able to get to understand something, it's a slightly different approach maybe, but to try to teach somebody else about something is a really good way to be able to understand a topic or a subject. And actually, to an extent, that's what drives a lot of my blogging. It's not that I'm trying to teach, but more if I can articulate something in a way, an idea in my head, in a way that I think somebody else might be able to comprehend it. I'm not sure I always get that, but it's a really good way, just as a self-learning process and a helping to understand the way in which you are thinking. It's a good process to be able to think stuff through.
Yeah, I'd say to anybody out there who's got experience of management or leadership or anything really where they can do a bit of mentoring and get involved in their industry organisations, I'd encourage them to do it. And also anybody who's thinking of finding a mentor, do that too, because the amount you can learn from people, the amount that you can still, no matter how far you go in your career, there's always people you can learn from. So I think it's a really valuable step.
So my first one is the weird contradiction that we seem to be entering into. In a year when, on the one hand, the technology industry has been saying the future is about data and evidence-based decision-making and the use of data to be able to predict the future. And on the other hand, a year in which electorates in the US and the UK have basically looked at facts and so-called experts, stick two big fingers up in the air and tell them to bugger off. And for me, I think there's something really interesting underpinning that, and that's that the way in which we have a culture, particularly within business at the moment, that is superficially objective and actually is still mostly driven by subjective views. Not because necessarily that's a bad thing, but just because actually most stuff is actually fundamentally subjective. I was in some meetings recently where I saw people create these enormous great spreadsheets. I think they called it multivariate decision making. And what it was enormous great spreadsheets created with layer upon layer of graphics and all sorts of things. And underlying it all were some assumptions that had been knocked up in a room. And that all the spreadsheet was to add airs of graces of objectivity to what was basically people's gut feel underneath it. And actually, why have we got to a state where we're not allowed to be able to say, no, this is gut feel and this is what I think is right? And also confusing subjective numbers with objective numbers. And that's a really dangerous thing to be in. But I say, I think that if you look at, say, the opinion polling around politics this year, really interesting, it might be actually that the opinion polling has got a bit ropey now because of what Taleb talks about as black swan events, that actually you can predict the future as long as it's relatively similar to the past, based on past experience, until something untoward happens, in which case predictions go out the window. I just think there's a whole lot of contradiction in all of that at the moment. I just find particularly interesting in this year.
No, that's very true. That's very true. People's subjective views are generally the most powerful ones taken into account when making a decision. This business of trying to pull up complicated spreadsheets and etc. is generally speaking to appease a blame culture, I think, in my experience, so that you can justify yourself if it all goes wrong. And it's rarely, when it gets to that level, it rarely a useful use of time.
The one other thing I think, and this has occurred, something that occurred to me in some conversations recently, is also that if you get into that obsession around everything being needed to be justified with numbers, you end up only really ever doing things that can happen rather than preventing things that don't happen, because it's easy to measure stuff that happens. It's really hard to measure stuff that doesn't happen. And describing that as being, we will celebrate in organisations firefighting, we find it very, very difficult to prevent those fires happening in the first place. And that's just odd.
Well, it is. And I think it moves on to my second point that I wrote about today, and that's the fact that it is still all about data, that people have chased different models, they've chased cloud, they've chased new ways of delivering software and applications and mobile and all those sort of things. And these are all fantastic and very, very important. But at the end of the day, it is still all about the data. And the data has often been forgotten about, not in its sense, but the way it's dealt with in the banks and places like that, where you've still got the mainframe computers chugging away or bits of NT, Microsoft NT, running around because they can't afford to replace them because of too many front-end processes that would have to change. The data is still the core of it, and people get bamboozled by the sheer amount of data that we create now. This idea that we're all creating gigabytes of data every day as we browse and blog and post on Twitter and post on Facebook. People either get cynical about it and say it's all worthless, or they become overconfident and they say, well, we now can figure out just about everything because we've got all this information. When actually the structure of your data and just using a bit of self-control over what you store or what you use is still the key, I think. And there are lots of organizations who are making a good job of that, and not always for what you might call positive means, and some of the things that Facebook are doing are a little bit creepy, but they do a really good job of managing their data. But you've also got the government now trying to control data and control the digital world in a really cack-handed way with the Digital Economy Bill and the Investigatory Powers Act, which is truly, truly odd. The fact that you can't legally now have a long-distance conversation with anybody is really, it's fundamental to what we do. And the fact that all this information is going to be collected and probably lost because breaches in government last year, that's really worrying.
One of the things about the obsession with data, though, that we have at the moment is, when did we start to just interchangeably use the terms data and information again? So I remember the, 25 years ago when I was doing what little bit of computing I did at university, it's a very important hierarchy that data wasn't as good as information, because data was just the raw stuff and then information was something that you did with it. And yet we just talk about day-to-day, data science this, data science that. When did we lose sense of the importance of information over data?
Well, I guess that's right. And now we have data lakes, of course. And I saw quite a good simile about data lakes turning into data swamps while you watch, because it's also, it goes stagnant and nobody really knows what's of value anymore. And that's a right. That's a very, very reasonable point, Matt. It's not all useful until it's information.
There's also that fantastic metaphor talking about how data should be treated rather than being as a source of infinite wealth like oil. It should be treated more like a source of infinite danger like nuclear waste, and that we don't know what to do with this, and storing it and storing it and creating it and creating it is possibly just building up an enormous great problem for some point in the future, which I think is a very interesting probably quite strong analysis of obsessive collection of data these days.
Yeah, I wonder though whether it's storing up problems for the people who are storing it, or other people, and maybe that's where the analogy falls down.
So next one, my second, and that's I spent a lot of time this year working in the world of law, not as a lawyer. That would be quite a significant career shift for me, but working with actually in the end a number of law firms to think about what impact digital and technology transformation and technology disruption is having on the second oldest profession, as I like to call it. I don't know if everybody else does, but it tickles me that. And the thing that struck me more than anything was seeing an industry, and I don't think actually it's just legal that's in this space at the moment. I think there are a number of the traditional professions that are in a similar sort of space, where technology is still pretty much exclusively seen as a way to be able to reduce operating cost rather than being able to use to create new services, and an industry where basically the core business is about protected knowledge and having exclusive access to and an exclusive right to practice upon a set of professional knowledge that sets you apart from your non-competition, because you've basically got a closed shop on it. And that in the era of the internet, having closed access to private information is basically a liability. And it was just really interesting to be able to spend some time. I'm increasingly interested by industries that are trailing in terms of adoption of technology, because I think there's a lot of interesting things to be done in places where they're not at the cutting edge, and they don't think that they're at the cutting edge, but therefore can learn from everything that's gone before them, but almost certainly with inherent kind of inertia and friction to be able to get any change to happen. And I think the thing that has left me most with the 6 or so months of working with people in the legal profession is that it is an industry that is going to come into some quite significant disruption over the next few years, and probably won't in many cases know what has hit it.
I think that's spot on. And the same for recruitment that we talked about last week. And I've been speaking to a number of recruiters recently about their business and about how they are going to is going to happen to them. And the smart ones, of course, know that this black book culture that you've just referred to with law and is in recruiting is going to go by the wayside. Experience and their personal networks will still be important, but people are just becoming far more connected. So that a thing of the past, that the black book is a thing of ultimate value. But they don't know what to do next. There's lots of things they could do. But as you say, it sometimes is better to be leaping a generation of technology rather than wandering off down a cul-de-sac because you haven't really got a plan. You just think you must do something, and here is something, therefore we must do it.
So my next one is something I picked up a bit when working in law firms, but have also seen in a number of other sectors, in other professional services organisations, in government, in big utilities, in a bunch of big old school organisations. And that is that the question of whether you should use cloud or not is still a question. And as it sort of amazes me, really, because I've been involved in cloud computing for nearly 10 years now, one way or another. And it's just I don't understand why people have this question about it anymore. When I've implemented stuff, I've gone all into the cloud, because why would you want to run anything yourselves anymore? It's still a question. But then even more, then the question about mobile, I think the cloud thing is at different levels in different industries. At work now, we should be able to do everything that we need to do on a smartphone. End of story. We should be able to. That isn't even a question in many organisations. In many organisations, the smartphone is still seen as a secondary device to take telephone calls and maybe process email. And that is going to be the thing that will kill the IT industry if we don't get our asses in gear with this soon. Because actually, if you look at the way in which we use computing devices outside of work now, which is the sort of trend-setting approach, the mobile phone is the primary tool. It is the main thing that we have to be able to do stuff with the internet, to be able to do stuff with communicating with people, to be able to transact the whole lot. And if you go into most businesses, and I ask people a lot, when I go to events and stuff, there's a question I ask, how many people do most of their computing now on mobile phone outside of work? Most hands go up. How many people can do everything they need to do at work on their smartphone? And hardly any hands in the room go up at all. This has got to change.
Yes, and I think technologically it can work. But I, for example, not very long ago, where I was asked to provide a mobile phone for somebody or a tablet because they couldn't see it when they were out of the office. And the question I ask is, well, why are you looking at spreadsheets out of the office? What is it that you're trying to achieve? And the answer is that the customer records are on it. And the CRM system, for example, where they should be, which is a mobile client. So people's initial response these days to anything is to create a spreadsheet, and it has been for a long time. And if you start there, then you sometimes stay there, and that can opportunities with your IT and the way you work. So element to this, it's a culture change from using the what was once upon a time described to me as the greatest back of a fag packet in the world, which is Microsoft Excel. Stop using that and start using a tool that's meant for it. But we're a long way from that.
Okay, we're halfway through. Join us in a moment, and we will continue with our list of 10 things that we learned in 2016.
So my third thing I've learned this year is probably a reinforcement, and it plays into your point earlier on when I was talking about mentoring, about why you blog and why we do those things. And it's about how we interact with others and how we see others in our workplace. I've worked with some brilliant people this year, really, really, really top-notch people. And I've also worked with people who have caused me to bash my head against the wall repeatedly because I just couldn't get them to understand simple things, in my view. But it's really easy for everybody, and I include myself in this, to project your own experience onto others and assume that they can see things and through the same eyes that you can. And it's also really easy to not then see the filters that other people see things through. And that's part of the cause of most problems in projects and business is people not seeing things through the same lens. And I do think that blogging and this kind of podcasting and doing speaking gigs and things like that, it makes you think about what you say. Sometimes it makes you think about what you've said. But if you do those things, you do help yourself take those presumptions away. And I think that's really important. That's something that I guess I learn on a regular basis, and then I forget and have to relearn. But it's I think something that you have to just take into whatever you do and try to make sure that you're not assuming everybody can see things in the same way that you can.
It's one of those fundamentals, isn't it, of people's ability to be able to influence successfully, I think. That influence comes in two forms. You've got influence through power, and that's used still an awful lot, and an awful lot of power, an awful lot of people with power are able to use that power to be able to force their influence upon people. And power isn't just about status, although they tend to be related. And then you've got people who are able to influence almost through empathy, which is to be able to influence by being able to connect with other people and get things across to other people in a way that it fits for the people that they're communicating with. And that is a much harder thing, because being able to get out of your own mindset and into the mindset of the other is really hard. And it's the other thing about it is I find a lot of the time that the people that I'm trying to be able to get to see things differently are people who on the outside appear to be able to exhibit no empathy themselves. And there's this almost logic problem, which is how do you demonstrate empathy to somebody who doesn't have empathy? Because you can't, because if you're being empathetic, you're into their mindset, and their mindset is one that they can't accept there's another worldview. And that one, I bashed my head against a wall with that one a number of times. But a lot of the stuff that I do and talk about how the people part of technology-led change is the bit that most organisations screw up on, and that the technologists, the hardcore technologists, don't acknowledge that because they don't see the people as being as important as the important stuff in their mind, which are these inanimate objects called computers.
Well, that's right, and even that plays back into our previous comments about people relying on data to prove whether they were right or wrong. People fall back on the process map and say, well, if everybody just followed the process, it would work fine, without ever wondering why people don't follow the process and whether the process is fit for purpose, or whether you can just have one process or one set of processes for certain activities. And I saw that that thing that's on the internet every day, you know, that one that says people I like working with are people, what are they? There are three things: people that get shit done, people that have fun, people that do something else. And there's a subset in the middle of all of these that people I enjoy working with, which is great if people were always all the same, but of course they're not. And you can't expect people to have the same head on all the time. Sometimes they'll be more reflective and sometimes they'll be more cautious, because the situation or their life or whatever is causing that to happen. So it's a tough one.
It brings me on to the next thing that I've learned this year, and this is a theme that I'm talking more and more about, and it's been able to help me to be able to come up with some sort of structure for the madly eclectic bunch of things that I've been doing for the last specifically for the last 3 years, but actually for much of my career. And that's this idea of play and the power of play, and how my little thesis, and talking about the idea of having to get people over to my way of thinking, we'll see where this goes over the next year or so. But my thesis is that organisations and individuals, actually, as we get older, we systematically remove our ability to play. And what we do is we want to follow rules, and we want to know what outcomes are, and we want to be able to know what it is before we do it, so that when we do it, we know what we're going to do. And that's fine, as long as all you ever want to do is something that you've done before, or something that an organisation has done before, or just to follow everybody else. But if you want to innovate, and if you want to be able to do things differently, you've got to be able to explore the power of play. You've got to be able to tinker with things. You've got to be able to do things just for the sake of doing them, just to see what happens, which is pretty much the justification behind doing this podcast in the first case. And you know, there's a bunch of things that I do where I just kind of, that seems like it could be interesting, and let's see what happens. Some of it works, some of it doesn't, and it's just this kind of ongoing experimentation thing. There's been a number of things over the last 12 months that have enabled me to be able to tie together a number of themes about what I do into this overriding simple idea of people need to play more, organisations need to play more. And 2017, hopefully, will be the opportunity by which I turn that into a book. I'm in negotiations with a number of people at the moment about doing that, not least my wife. If I could actually just be able to encapsulate all of that into 10 chapters, I think that would be a major achievement for me. And again, actually living it out is also about, I think it would be a really good thing to do. I think it could lead to some interesting new opportunities and what have you. It's not going to make me rich, but it would just be a sense of achievement out of doing it as well. So, yes, this importance of play will be something I'm sure we'll be coming back to more over 2017.
I think that's absolutely right. Nobody got anywhere just by doing the same thing over and over again, but doing it better. You have to try out different things, and sometimes you have to do that playing in your own time, like we do with this podcast, and then you take those lessons into other places. But yeah, organizations, especially the bigger they get, the worse they are at it, aren't they? That's a given, really. So my fourth point, my fourth lesson this year, something that has given me pause for thought, is it's all about paying it forward. You know, this idea that you give your advice, you give your ideas, you give your experience, and on the basis that other people have done it for you, so you should do it for other people. And I would say that most of my opportunities in the last few years, opportunities to meet people and to learn things and to do business, they've come about through connections and relationships that have had some of this paying it forward involved. Well, even if it's just making a connection between one person and another, getting them together because you know that they'll hit it off, or that they've got some technology that somebody else can use. I'm far too commercially naive to be doing that for any commercial gain. It's generally speaking because it's the right thing to do. It just feels that it should happen. But actually what it turns out is that's a really good investment, and it comes back to you. And those things that happened to me this year, and the business opportunities I've had are almost entirely down to doing that kind of thing. And I still see people who are a little bit cynical about it, but really I don't think we should be. I don't think people should be. I think it's a fine thing to do, and you should give your ideas away. There's no reason why not.
It's something I've really just been part of the way in which I've operated for many years now. And the thing for me is, was really encapsulated well. There's a book by a guy called Adam Grant called Give and Take. And in that, he describes three sorts of people: people who give, people who match, which is those who will do things but on the expectation they'll get something back, and then takers, who are basically exploitative arseholes. The people who do best in business are the takers, and also some of the givers. And the people who do worst are some of the givers. And the whole book is about how to be a giving type person but not get screwed over, basically. But that whole idea, there's this fantastic little nugget in that book which I've tried to be able to live to, which is the 5-minute rule, which is, if somebody asks you to do something that's not going to take you more than 5 minutes, don't hesitate. As long as it's not illegal, just do it. And that kind of attitude about just being able to be open to share, to network, and to just give, I think it, well, almost all of my work has come through my network, which is as a result of being able to be generous in the time I give to people, and not expecting anything back, just because I do it because it's the right thing to do.
That was a nice bit, wasn't it? Well, aren't we nice?
I know. Which brings me on to my last one then, which is I did a load of research at the end of last year and at the beginning of this year, and then spent quite a long time writing the report for it for Leading Edge Forum, all about the role of collaboration in work. And the report, if you want to have a read of it, get in touch and I'm sure I can rustle up a copy for you. We looked in the research at a number of factors about what it is to collaborate in organisations, how technology might support collaboration, different styles of collaboration. And the thing, I think, over everything, of the whole lot, that stuck in my mind from that piece of work was the first rule of collaboration is stop talking about collaboration, because it's meaningless. Because to say we want to collaborate more in an organisation is like saying we want to work more. The core thing is people working together in teams is really hard to do, but to do it without any meaningful purpose is even harder. And that's where a lot of collaboration projects go awry, because they just talk about collaboration as this end point in its own right, where actually getting people working together more effectively is a method by which you get other things to happen. And that actually is something that I think I need to, you know, actually keep telling myself as much as anything else. But I think it was a useful lesson out of that research.
Okay, well, my final piece of learning this year was, I guess, and again, we've talked about it a little bit, is about how people do make odd decisions. And really, I'm thinking about the vote in June, the Brexit vote, and also then our delight at seeing the United States of America vote Donald Trump as their president-elect. And I guess because I come from a background in my, I guess I'm that sort of person, and that's why I chose that path. But I'm, you know, I've done a technology and engineering subjects academically, and I tend to try to make judgments and decisions based on information and based on history, experience, and also on people's judgments and people with better knowledge than me. Whereas a lot of things this year seem to have been, the idea that somebody would know any better seems to be anathema, and those people that know better are somehow tainted by their expertise, and we've got to take a gut decision. And one of the nicest comments I heard during the European referendum debate was, if you're going to choose between your heart and your head to make a decision, try to remember that your heart is essentially a pump and the head is meant for thinking. And that's how I tend to work. But whilst I've been dismayed by Brexit, because I just think it's self-defeating. I think, you know, nobody could claim to love the European Union, really, could they, with its various inefficiencies and corruption, and by no means perfect. But the idea that we'll be better off outside with the amount of upheaval that's going to go on seems to me, in the short term or short to medium term, very odd. And then we've got Donald Trump and climate change denial and all of these things that could bring even more catastrophe to all of us. So it makes me a bit sad. But I think, okay, how can I react to this? I'm not in the government. I can't change the policy. It's just about finding ways to make the organisations I work with more successful, and to make sure that you just make the best of it and do the best job you can.
I think the other thing you probably should do is read a book called The Art of Thinking Clearly by Ralph DeBelli. I'll put a link on the website to it. The way in which we make decisions, this is the problem of having an engineering background, Chris, I'm afraid, because it makes you think that everything is nice and logical, but it ain't. And there's this one particular bias that we have. I can't remember the name of it, but if you find two people and you give them £10 to be able to allocate between them, but you allow one person to be able to allocate the money and the other person decide as to whether the money should be given or not, something really interesting happens. If the person who is making the decision about how much money to split between the two people does it equitably, so say £5 each, the person making the decision about whether they should both get that money or not will make the decision that money should be given. If the person making the decision about how much money, how it should be split, makes it inequitably, so they say, I'll have £9 and you'll have £1, logic dictates that the other person making the decision about whether they should have the right amount, or they should get the money or not, should say yes, because they're a pound up, or they get no money at all. But with a very high proportion, the person who feels that they have been slighted in this decision-making process will say, you can have nothing, I will have nothing, I'd rather spite you than you give an inequitable decision. Now, I think that actually that kind of psychology may underpin quite a lot of what's gone on in the last 12 months in elections in various countries. And it's not simple logic at all. And it's much more about the human psyche. And it's not a lot. We're not logical creatures. We work with a whole bunch of things that go on that actually have made us an incredibly successful species. We shouldn't think of these as cognitive bugs. They're not. They're the way in which we become the most, well, arguably the most successful creature on the planet. But it's not all based on Bayesian logic, unfortunately.
No, no, it's true, and we justify decisions after they've been made, and we don't even know why we made them half the time. Absolutely, things are complex, and people are complex. I guess with some of the bigger decisions that we make, though, because we make them as a collective, and we make them over a period of time, people have tended to think that in the end, an outcome should be a reasonable outcome. Whereas some of what's happened recently doesn't seem reasonable, but maybe that's just my way of looking at things.
So there we go, 10 things we've learned in 2016. Not all doom and gloom, although it has been a remarkably bizarre year, and no doubt in the time that we've been recording this, somebody else famous has also died. We're going to take a break for Christmas, between now and then, you can listen to our back catalogue of another 8 episodes of this. I had to warn you that the ones at the beginning were slightly dodgy audio-wise, probably slightly dodgy content-wise as well, to be honest. If you are interested in hearing me talk more about the concepts of play, but also, more importantly, want to go and see some really fantastic speakers speak, including BT's Nicola Millard, who is this wonderful person who does a whole bunch of stuff around innovation in technology, working for BT, and she's based up in Suffolk. And also Lee Bryant, who is a consultant at a company called PostShift, they are a fascinating organisation. There's an event taking place on the 27th of January, which is about digital leadership in customer experience. Tickets are available now, and if you book before, I think, the end of this week, you can get a 20% discount, which is value in anybody's book, I would say. Anyway, that's the plug over and done with. Looking forward to Christmas, Chris?
Of course. Christmas is going to be a time of much rejoicing in the Western household, as the children get everything that they wanted, I'm sure. I'm sure that's going to happen, as Father Christmas never lets them down. And then into the new year, where we've got lots of things going on. I've got loads of things to be getting on with, and also we've got some great interviews coming up next year. I've already lined up several at my end. I know you've got some interviews lined up. We're going to have some fantastic podcasts in the first weeks of next year.
Absolutely. So we're going to be about the second week of January. Between now and then, maybe wish you an extremely Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year, and whatever other denominational or non-denominational holiday greetings you wish to be able to take from us.
Well done, Matt.
Thank you very much. See you in the new year, Chris.
Merry Christmas.
Don't forget, you can follow us at WB40 Podcast on Twitter, you can find us on iTunes, and you can find us on the web at WB40podcast.com. See you in 2017.